This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Bill Ferris was just a little boy when he snapped his first photograph, took a shot of the family at the dinner table. Little did he know that that would foreshadow his life's work. For decades, Bill has conducted interviews with Southern musicians, writers, painters, and others. He's taken photographs and traveled to front porches of blues musicians in the Mississippi Delta and sat in the living rooms of famous writers like Eudora Welty and Alex Haley. Over the years, Bill's work took him to the Delta, from there to D.C., up to Yale. In D.C., he served as chairman of the National Endowment for the Humanities under President Clinton. Today, his expansive collection lies in the Southern Folklife Collection at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. There, he also serves as Senior Associate Director for the Center for the Study of the American South. Bill Ferris, welcome back to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Frank. It's great to be with you.
Take me back to that dinner table and your Kodak Brownie camera, that first photograph. Tell me about it.
Well, it was a kind of a magical moment to see the flash go off and know that inside that little box, somehow you'd registered all your family about to have Christmas dinner.
What did the camera mean to you? I mean, were you thinking about, you know, the potential, you know, like I had one of those and I had a lot of fun with it, but were you sort of imagining, you certainly could not have been imagining a career at that moment, right?
It was really, you know, I have a fascination with technology, and the camera is a magical box to be able to record that moment. And it was my first step in creating a picture that would come back with negatives and photographs and a little envelope. And you were off and running. And it was really just capturing family, my own and families around our farm, that started. I didn't know that I was photographing something I would call the South. It was just my world, and the camera was my way of entering it.
Tell us more about that world in rural Mississippi.
It was a very isolated world, 15 miles outside of Vicksburg on a gravel road, and this was the end of the road before it left the county, and the families had lived there. They were all black families on the farm, and they were like an extended family. The children were my best friends when I was growing up. The stories that circulated within the community, the little church, Rose Hill Church, where I first went when I was 4 or 5 years old with a wonderful lady named Mary Gordon. Those were the memories that really shaped me as a person and started me in a course of travel to understand those worlds.
Tell me more about those church services with Mary Gordon.
Well, I was really going more to as a form of babysitting. She was taking me away from my parents, which they were happy to have every first Sunday, and it was a church in which there were no hymnals. All the hymns were sung from memory, and they were sung a cappella. So the church would fill with these voices, and then the preaching of the sermon would be this unbelievably powerful sermon with music interrupting it. And that really kind of shaped my earliest awareness of music. And I learned those hymns. I could sing along. So it was forming and educating me in ways that I didn't fully understand, but I still resonate to today.
Did you also have experience? Did you go to the White Church, or were you there every
Sunday? I did. This was only on the first Sunday. But my parents attended. They were not really seriously religious, but as part of the culture, they went to a Presbyterian church, and that was much more formal, and it was not a service that touched me in the way that the Rose Hill service did.
Talk more about your parents and their understanding of race relations at the time.
Well, my parents were unusual. They were both college-educated, and they were from families who valued education. And they respected the relationship of black and white families in our community. They tried to take a leadership role in bringing health care and education to both black and white. And they told us in no uncertain terms that the N-word would never be used in our home, that all people should be treated fairly. And those were lessons that I learned very early. And my father was respected by the black community as one of the few whites they would go to for advice when they were thinking of purchasing something or when they had a decision to make. He was viewed by the black community as a friend, and I didn't know that at the time, but I later learned it. But my parents were very caring, not only about us as their children, but about the community. They engaged in building better facilities for the local school, a community center. And that was a lesson that I continue to feel blessed to have been a part of.
I wonder how you felt as a young man going to that church, Rose Hill, the black church in your community in rural Mississippi. You know, how you felt being an outsider. Were you the only or one of very few white people at that service?
I was the only one as a child. I felt very much at home because I knew all the people. Mm. They were people that I grew up with on the farm, and the minister, Reverend Isaac Thomas, lived in Vicksburg, and this was one of four churches that he was part of, and each week in the month he would go to a different church, and Rose Hill was the first Sunday. But other than Reverend Thomas, most of the people in the church I knew really very well from childhood. I knew their names, their families, and they were very generous in accepting me as a part of that community in the church.
Eventually, you did document Rose Hill Church and that community and the stories of Mary Gordon. Was this one of your first projects and one of the first places you thought about as you moved into folklore?
It was. It was sort of like the camera. I didn't know what I was doing, but I knew that I wanted to record and photograph these services because I realized, because there were no hymnals, that when the families were no longer there, that the music would disappear. And I felt an urgency to record those hymns, and without knowing why or if it was of any value, it was simply a personal decision that I made.
Eventually, you did interview Mary Gordon. We have her here singing a song that I'm sure she didn't sing in church, You Shall Be Free, but it certainly is part of the tradition and was abroad in her community at that time. Let's listen to Mary Gordon, You Shall Be Free.
Our Father, who art in heaven, the preacher opened me $10 and paid me $7. The kingdom come, I will be done. If I hadn't took the $7, I wouldn't have gotten none. Had to fight about my money. What he owed me, you shall be free. Some people say that a preacher wouldn't steal. I caught about $7 and cut all the milk for you. Cutting and slicing and tearing up my vine. Save my vine, brother, you shall be free. Save the rinds, you shall be free. Don't rob me, you shall be free. Oh, when the good Lord set you free. When I first moved to Memphis, Tennessee, went out on my front porch walking around. I invite the preacher over to my house. Washed his face, combed his head. Next thing he wanted to do, slip in my bed. I caught him by the head, man, kicked him out the door. Don't lie, no preacher around my house no more. Don't like him, you shall be free. They'll rob you, you shall be free. Steal your daughter, you shall be free. Take your wife from me, you shall be free. Oh, when the good Lord set you free. That's just an old thing, you know. It's not true. That ain't no church hymn. It's just something I hear somebody else singing and picked it up.
You Shall Be Free, an interview with Mary Gordon, that interview done by folklorist Bill Ferris in the 1960s. Tell us more about that. I mean, when did you decide that it was important to collect these as a collection, as something that you wanted to preserve?
Well, when I was at Davidson College, I stumbled on a set of recordings that John and Alan Lomax had done for the Library of Congress. And a light went off in my head because I knew the Library of Congress was important, and these Lomax recordings were very important. And I felt like someone had been there ahead of me and legitimized the work that I instinctively was trying to do. Just like snapping that camera, recording those hymns were things that I did instinctively.
Not only the hymns that were sung in church, but the ones that were sung outside. And I think that's the hallmark, or one of the hallmarks of your work, Bill, is that it presents a much more nuanced picture of the South and some of the things that are unexpected for those of us who didn't grow up here. It's amazing work, and we'll talk more about it when my conversation with folklorist Bill Ferris continues. He's Senior Associate Director of the Center for the Study of the American South at UNC Chapel Hill. We'll talk more about Bill's work in documenting the lives of Southerners in the Mississippi Delta on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio, today talking with Bill Ferris, who has spent decades documenting Southern culture, serves as Senior Associate Director for the Center of the Study of the American South at UNC Chapel Hill. So we're talking about growing up. Now you've had the brownie, you've done some interviews. Talk about your college experience. You talked about going to Davidson, right? Mm-hmm.
Right. I was at Davidson from 60 to 64. When civil rights were really starting to happen, we were organizing desegregation of Davidson. There were no blacks there when I first went. I was working in the community with the black families. I helped organize a civil rights march in Charlotte. There was a lot happening, and music was part of that. When I would go to gatherings of students through the YMCA, I remember there was one where the SNCC Freedom Singers were present, and I'll never forget, we gathered in a circle and started singing We Shall Overcome, and I was standing next to one of the SNCC singers, and it was like the ground was shaking, these amazing voices. So music and folk music was part of the effort to change the segregated South in ways that I felt had to happen. The hymn, We Shall Overcome, that Pete Seeger put together was part of that. And we were singing these songs at student gatherings. I was learning to play the guitar. And we were learning most of our music from Alan Lomax's big book, Folk Music USA. So music and folklore were part of what I saw as a protest and an effort to change the old segregated worlds of the South.
It's so important to understand and realize the importance of what you're saying, because critical to that movement, which was revolutionary, right? It was about changing structures that were in place to protect privilege, was the maintaining and honoring tradition. It was saying that this freedom we're talking about, this new thing, is actually rooted in something very conservative, our own past.
Right? Yes. And somehow I felt what I could do that would be most important was to continue these recordings of people who were largely unknown. And without those recordings, their memory, their history would disappear with their death. And I began to see not only the music, but the voices of telling about the conditions of growing up black in Mississippi or poor and white. And the sort of human story, which I felt very strongly through the short stories of Eudora Welty, the dramatic monologues that she created had a kind of visceral presence that these voices that I was recording had. And I saw a clear connection between the oral histories I was doing and the literary body of work that writers like Eudora Welty and William Faulkner, Richard Wright were creating. So I was sort of walking between those two worlds of both written and oral literature.
And getting a taste of the resistance. I mean, you talked about acceptance within your community in Mississippi and African-American communities. Certainly your parents offered a much more open-minded idea and viewpoint on race. And you come to Davidson, there was and working for civil rights. But talk about the backlash that you received. You tried to teach Sunday school, or were teaching
yes.
Sunday school. Tell us that story.
Well, I was. There were three Presbyterian churches in the town of Davidson, one for the college students, another for the white mill workers, and the third for blacks. And so I began going to the black church and teaching Sunday school. And my parents received postcards through the mail saying these were anonymously written, saying that they knew they would be pleased to know I was dating blacks and using the N-word. And this was the kind of world in which we lived in the early 60s. And my college dorm room was blown up with firecrackers. I had pepper put in my bed. There was, you know, at that age, you don't care. You believe something is right, and you do it. And there were a number of students and faculty there who strongly supported what we were doing. We met with leaders of CORE and SNCC, and this was our generation, and we were going to change the South, and we didn't know how, but we were doing whatever we felt was possible, and there was clearly a backlash to that.
Well, and as you described earlier, your contribution, as you saw it, was collecting these stories and making sure that this body of knowledge and these stories weren't lost. When did you decide to go back to Mississippi then and do your recordings?
Well, I was doing them all along. When I was there during holidays at Christmas, in the summer when I worked on the farm with my father and brother and the men who worked there, I would find time to do the recordings. And I had an old beat-up tape recorder. And later in graduate school, I got more sophisticated equipment. But I felt that this was a mission that I was on. And the more I did it, the more I felt I was on the right path, because the voices of people like Mary Gordon were just incredibly powerful. And you felt like this is a moment that is going to be important forever if you simply capture it.
You learned a few things about how to capture those voices or how to go about it. When you tried to find blues musicians in the Delta, an interesting story about sort of your first entree. Tell us how that went, because apparently there was a protocol to follow initially to find these black musicians. Tell us that story.
Well, I was told that you should, you know, find a white leader in the community who could take you to a black family. So the first time I did that, these white farmers came with their pickup trucks with guns in the back window, and they threw rocks on the tin roof that was where the black blues singer lived, and he came out, and they instructed him to play the blues, which he did reluctantly. Mm-hmm. And I could feel the tension and the discomfort. So I went back a few days later alone, and he welcomed me. And he told me, you don't need to come with these white people. He said, I own my own farm. And in no uncertain words, he said, you come here and I'll take care of you.
This was James Blackboy Hughes, right? Well, let's listen to part of that interview that you did with him on the second visit.
Come on in.
All right.
Do that. Next time I come, I'll come to you and not to them.
Don't come to him.
I'm going to come to you.
Come to me. Right. I'm the boss out there.
Okay.
I'm the boss of the whole place over there. But you ain't got to ask no white folks about coming to my house. And anytime you drive my house, if I ain't there, stay right there till I come. Mm-hmm. Don't leave. Don't leave. I'm coming back.
That's a clip from the interview by Bill Ferris, the blues musician James Hughes, 1968. Bill, tell us about why, you know, after that experience, because I'm guessing it's not the first time white farmers and locals came throwing rocks at his house saying, come on out and play for us, John. So, James, how did he come to trust you so quickly, or did he?
Well, I think he knew I was there to understand and to record his music. And when you came alone, it was an act of defiance. If I had come back again with the whites, he would have known the difference. But I came alone, and he knew I was no longer part of that system that had to have permission. So afterwards, I went straight into the black communities, and I tried to avoid the white community in towns like Leland, Mississippi. And I felt that I was taken in and protected by those families. I would stay with them, and they understood that I was going to basically tell it the way it is. And they said, if I tell you this story, promise me you will put it out there and tell it the way it is. And I said, I promise you I will do that.
You met a musician named James Son Ford Thomas, right? And he was somebody who I think had an important effect on you. Tell us about your relationship.
Well, he was really my teacher. And when I first met him in 1967, I was looking for blues singers in the black community, and someone sent me to his home in Black Dog, and I knocked on the door, and his wife, Christine, came to the door, and she says, what do you want, looking at this white kid? I said, I'm looking for James Thomas. She said, he doesn't live here. So I said, oh, I'm sorry, and I turned to walk away, and she said, what do you want with him? I said, I'm going to do a book on the blues, and I want to put him in it. And she said, he'll be back in about an hour. You sit down and wait. So I did, and that was the beginning of a friendship that went on for many years until his death. And we traveled together at the National Folk Festival in Washington. He came to speak to my students at Yale at the University of Mississippi. And I introduced him to Allen Ginsberg, who was very moved by his music. And Allen, after speaking to him, turned to me and he said, he is your guru. I said, that's right.
What did you learn from him?
I learned what it was like to grow up black in Mississippi as a child. I learned about the meaning of the blues, which he described as a deep study, something you have to work with your whole lifetime to understand, both as a musician and as a student. And I learned about the elegant, gentle way that he had in dealing with children and dealing with my students. He was the gentlest and most soft-spoken person with a profound sense of humanity and of what the blues was all about.
It's interesting that you would say that. I think the first sentence was, I learned what it was like to grow up black in the South. You had a good relationship with African-American families. You felt taken in. You went to the church. You had every right to think as a white man. You had a pretty good feel for that. And yet, clearly you knew that there was something that you didn't, and there was something else. Did it come as a surprise to you? I mean, was this a sort of moment of humility for you to say, whatever you were thinking, Bill, let go of it? Or did you go more gently into that depth of knowledge?
Well, I knew I had read the autobiography of Malcolm X. I mean, I knew that the experience of black Americans was so different from mine, although I grew up in a community of black families who knew me and knew me as part of that world. But when I was in the Mississippi Delta, they did not know me. They only knew me as someone who came in and at clear risk was going to be a part of their community. And they saw me as someone who had come to record their story. And they told their stories in unfiltered ways that I think are very significant. And I knew that that world was there, but I had to have their voices lead me through it and reveal it, sort of lifting the veil of understanding.
And that, of course, is what a professional folklorist would do. You weren't doing folklore as a profession. When did it, at that time, early on, when did it become a profession for you? Or did you? When did you find out that that's what you wanted to do?
Well, I kept running into walls in the study of English literature at Northwestern University doing a master's. I was told that it was not appropriate or permitted to study the blues, the folk tales, the ballads as literature. So I had a year's study in Dublin, Ireland. I was working on James Joyce at Trinity College on a Rotary Foundation fellowship. And over breakfast one morning, I was talking with the chair of the English department at Ohio State, Francis Utley, who had come there to do work on folklore. And I complained to him that English departments were so narrow. And he said, "My friend, you should be in folklore." And I said, "What is that?" And he explained, and that changed my life. I applied and was accepted at the University of Pennsylvania. And when I went in to meet my advisor, Kenneth Goldstein, I took a box of my tapes and photographs, and I put it on his desk, and I said, "Is this the kind of thing I can do here in folklore?" And he smiled, and he said, "My boy, that will be your dissertation."
And was it?
It was. I was so happy that I'd found a home in folklore. Yeah.
You finished your doctorate and went into the military, but then were soon released as a conscientious objector. Tell us about that.
I had been uncomfortable with the war in Vietnam, and at Davidson in ROTC, I failed the exams. I have a mental block against learning military information. And I was probably the only student there that ever failed their exams. And they told me, "Well, you'll get over this." I said, "I don't believe in killing." So when I went into the Army after my PhD, I had the same problem. I was failing exams, and I refused to fire my rifle. And my commanding officer talked with me, and he said, "You really should apply for conscientious objector status." And I met a colonel there at Fort Bliss in Texas who had been at Davidson when I was a student. And he said, "How are you getting along, Ferris?" And I said, "I'm having problems." And he said, "What's the matter?" And I said, you know, I explained. And he said, "I remember you had the same issues." And he wrote a letter explaining that. And I was eventually processed out as a conscientious objector, and I told my draft board I would do 2 years of service at Jackson State, which was what I was trained to do. And so that led, without my knowing it, to an amazingly wonderful education that I received from my students and faculty in this historically black college.
You were there at an interesting time, too.
Yes, I arrived in the fall of 1970, right after the murders of the students at Jackson State and at Kent State, and many of the faculty had left. It was a very powerful moment, and when my wife and I looked for a place to live in the white neighborhoods, they would say, now, we, of course, are not prejudiced, but you really can't have black people come to visit you in your home if we rent to you. And we refused to do that. And so we ended up living in a black neighborhood two doors down from where Medgar Evers had been assassinated. And we had black and white family and neighbors and friends who were always welcome in our home. And that was said to be by friends like Alice Walker and others who were there at that time, you were behind the stockade was the phrase they used, because everyone was very much aware if you were part of that community within the black colleges. And it was a powerful moment for me.
My guest is folklorist Bill Ferris, Senior Associate Director for the Center for the Study of the American South at UNC Chapel Hill, and our conversation continues on the state of things after this. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, and my guest today, folklorist Bill Ferris. Bill has spent decades documenting Southern culture and serves as Senior Associate Director for the Center of the Study of the American South at UNC Chapel Hill, where he teaches as well. You were teaching at Jackson State for a while, then took a job at Yale as Associate Professor of African American Studies. Tell us what that was like, first of all, being a Southerner at Yale and then teaching African American Studies as a white man at Yale University.
It was an amazing time. I was the first white hired in Afro-American studies, and it was so exciting. Both the students and the faculty there with whom I worked were creating the whole field of Afro-American studies. Skip Gates, Henry Louis Gates, was an undergraduate student at that time. I was hired by John Blasingame, the editor of the Frederick Douglass papers. It was an amazingly rich moment to be at Yale, and I was bringing in James' son, Ford Thomas, to play the blues and to talk with students. I brought in a mule trader, Ray Lum, a storyteller. I brought Eudora Welty, B.B. King. And we were able to get an honorary doctorate of humane letters at Yale for both Eudora Welty and B.B. King. It was a moment of powerful meeting of people. And we brought, either they were on campus or we brought their writers like Robert Penn Warren, Cleanth Brooks, Alice Walker, Ernest Gaines. The resources were there. If you wanted to bring someone, you brought them. And I was like a kid in a candy shop, you know.
Well, rich experience for your students in the university. What was it like for you to be a Southerner? I understand that you had an interesting experience at a shoe store.
Yes. When I first arrived, I was totally naive, and I walked in to get some heavier boots for the winter, and the salesperson heard my accent. He said, "Where are you from?" And I said, "I'm from Mississippi." He said, "I thought you didn't wear shoes in Mississippi." I said, "We don't." I said, "That's why I've come to buy a pair."
And you held your hands up, said, "Do you think that you have anything that'll fit me?" Was there much of that there? Because I've, you know, especially around that time period you're talking about for Southerners who went north, it was a difficult experience.
Well, there was. I mean, you were seen as a foreign presence, is from a different culture. But what was interesting was that as a white Southerner, I felt a strong affinity with black students and faculty. And the fact I was hired in the Afro-American Studies Department, I think, underscored that. We shared a common history that was, when you found yourself in New Haven, Connecticut, you bonded rather quickly. And I remember one of the people, we taught a team-taught course, Introduction to Afro-American Studies, with Willie Ruff, a jazz musician from Alabama, Larry Neal, a black folklorist and poet, and Robert Ferris Thompson, the art historian. And Larry lived in Harlem. He would commute up for our class. And after class, we'd go over to my place and just sit around and talk about folklore and blues. And there was a deep affinity at Yale, and there's a long history of Southerners teaching at Yale and of students coming there to study.
You talked about bringing B.B. King, among others, into your class. How did you meet B.B. King?
Well, I gave a lecture at a Black History conference on blues, and I played B.B.'s music and spoke about his music. And after that, a young woman came up and said, "I represent B.B. King, and I think he would like to meet you and come to your class." And I said, "That would be the greatest honor of my life." So we set it up, and he came with his band, and the students were absolutely elated. And he came a number of times, and it was the beginning of a lifelong friendship that we shared at Yale in Mississippi and at the National Endowment for the Humanities, where he came and performed for our staff there.
You interviewed him a number of times, of course. Here's part of an interview from the early 1970s between Bill Ferris and B.B. King.
The man says, "Why I sing the blues is because I lived it. And I know how it feels. When you're hurt, you gotta tell somebody. Someone must understand how you feel. And the only way to do it is say it loud and clear. Make sure that everyone will hear. It's the truth the way it is. And that's why I sing the blues. This is B.B. King making a statement and a natural fact. All you gotta do is sit back and dig where it's coming from. Listen, not only with your ear, but with your heart. Everybody want to know why I sing the blues."
B.B. King, from an early 1970s interview done by folklorist Bill Ferris, who is my guest today. Now, he is somebody, obviously, who made it. I mean, people knew about B.B. King and knew his story, but also, again, somebody who thought deeply about what his music meant, right?
Yes. B.B. had a deep sense of the importance of teaching the blues within the classroom. And I think he saw in me a way of getting access to making that happen. In addition to him coming and speaking to my students, we created at the University of Mississippi the Blues Archive, and he gave us his entire record collection to make that happen. And we began to create courses on blues, and today his dream has been realized. There are classes on blues. There are enormous numbers of books and scholarly articles, all of which recognize that B.B. was the greatest blues figure in American history.
Why do you think it was so important for people, famous and not so famous, the people you talked to? You said earlier in our conversation that the people who invited you into their homes to be interviewed wanted you to tell their story. Why do you think people felt that that would be so? Because I'm assuming they want you to tell your story to the larger community outside of their friends and families. Why do you think that was so important? How did they think it would change their lives?
Well, I think there was a sense of hopelessness within the Black community that the reality, the real truth, would never be told. And here, maybe it wouldn't happen, but at least it sounded like I was someone who would carry the message, who would tote the water for them. And it took many years before many of these stories were published in Give My Poor Heart Ease, but they are now there in their full glory and sadness and beauty. The voices of B.B. King, of Parchman Penitentiary inmates, of people within the churches. I was listening to Aretha Franklin recently, this powerful gospel soul voice whose father grew up in Clarksdale, Mississippi. And the people in this book, Give My Poor Heart Ease, from Clarksdale, were part of his community. And they really existed in a world that has been largely invisible to the white community.
You mentioned Parchman Prison. You were there and did interviews in the prison. When was that, and what was that like?
Well, I first was there in 1967, and I went there in search of the work chants that the Lomaxes had recorded there, and I was able to record those and photograph the inmates. And then I came back in 1974 and again recorded and filmed the work chants and did interviews with the inmates at that time.
How important is, you talked about the Lomaxes, and then of course Zora Neale Hurston was a folklorist mm-hmm. in her own right. And your chair, your endowed chair, is named for Joel Williamson, who is another important figure in this whole field of folklore. Talk about their importance to you in your career and to all of us.
Well, they are my teachers. The Lomaxes were there on the cutting edge and collected what is now in the Library of Congress, and I see it as the counterpart to Thomas Jefferson's library, which he gave, that created the first library, and the Lomax's library of recordings is a counterpart to that. Zora Neale Hurston represents this extraordinary young black woman who pursued education in the same way that I did, and found her way to Columbia University, where she worked with Franz Boas, who sent her back to Eatonville, Florida, to record her voices and music. And Joel Williamson is an extraordinary historian who taught all his life at the University of North Carolina, and who explored in his work race relations in the South. And he did that in the context of William Faulkner's life and the white and black worlds in his own family. He also did that in the work he did most recently on Elvis Presley. So all of these people, the Lomaxes, Zora Neale Hurston, and Joel Williamson, are icons to me who charted the way, and I've tried to follow in their footsteps.
Your work eventually brought you to the attention of the Clinton administration, and you served as chairman for the National Endowment for the Humanities. How did that come about?
Well, I don't really know what actually led me there, but I had a call out of the blue asking if I would come to Washington to have a discussion about the future of the humanities, and I said yes. And then I called them back, and I said they were going to have me come to the White House. And I said, I assume you're going to pay for the flight because I can't afford it. And they said, no, we're not. And I said, well, maybe we just better speak on the phone. So during that call, the person I spoke with, Ellen Lovell, said, we want to consider you for the chair of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Would you be willing to have that happen? I said, that would be unimaginably wonderful, and I, of course, would be happy to have my name put forward. Well, 6 months later, President Clinton selected me from the pool, and I never dreamed it would happen, but I was packed up and headed to Washington.
And like everything in Washington, the humanities are political. You had to make some fairly dramatic visits. Talk about meeting. I guess you hung around in liberal circles for a while, and then were finally pointed back to your own, what is now your home state.
Yes, Senator Kennedy told me when I saw him, says, "Don't waste your time with me. I love what you do. Go talk to the Republicans." So Bill Friday came up, and he said, "I want to make sure that you and Jesse Helms get along. We're going to go see Senator Helms." So we did, and he was very happy to see Bill Friday and was pleased to meet me. And he said, we talked about horse trading and country music and things that he relished. And he says to me, he says, how do you get along with Cuddin Trent Lott? Well, Trent Lott was the Republican whip from Mississippi who had sponsored my coming to Washington. And I said, we get along fine. And he said, well, let's go see Cuddin Trent. So we walked down the
Cuddin
hall.
Cuddin being North Carolina for cousin, I'm assuming.
Exactly. Okay. Cousin Trent, meaning they were like family.
Got it.
And so he was on his walker. We walked down the halls and into Trent Lott's office, and they all jumped to attention. And Trent Lott comes out putting his tie on. And he says, what can we do for you, Senator Helms? He said, I want to make sure you know my friend here, Bill Ferris. And he said, oh, we've got his encyclopedia right here on the table. So that opened the doors for bipartisan support. And we had $5 million added to the NEH budget the last 3 years I was there, enthusiastically added by both Republican and Democratic leaders.
The NEA, not such a warm relationship with said Jesse Helms.
No. And because our names both had the word endowment in them, the humanities, which had no real issues similar to what the arts had, were cut at the same way. Yeah. But we were able to rebuild both the arts and the humanities while I was there.
Well, I've left you very little time to talk about the Center for the Study of the American South at UNC Chapel Hill, but that is quite a library and growing. Give us an idea what's there, just roughly, and what is to come. You've got some exciting things on the way as well.
Well, the Center for Study of the American South is the flourishing of over a century of study of the South at UNC. We have the Southern Oral History Project, which has thousands of interviews with mill owners, mill workers, political leaders like Bill Clinton running for governor. We publish the Southern Cultures, which is a wonderful quarterly publication. We have Music on the Porch. It's a multifaceted, wonderful public venue on the American South.
It's great stuff, and Bill, always a pleasure to talk with you. We left a lot on the table. We just have to have you back and do more and talk about more of those archived interviews that you have in that warehouse and probably in your basement. Who knows? Anyway, Bill, always a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you.
Bill Ferris is Senior Associate Director of the Center for the Study of the American South at UNC Chapel Hill, where he teaches history. He is the author of many books, and you can find out more about that at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Will Michaels, Charlie Shelton, and Andrew Tye. Robin Copley is our Technical Director, Brent Wolf, WNC's News Director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.